So tomorrow morning in Santa Fe, the state of New Mexico, they're taking Meta to trial. And it is easily one of the most aggressive, sweeping child safety lawsuits in history.
Oh, absolutely. It's massive.
Right. I mean, we're talking injunctions aimed at banning infinite scroll during school hours, capping screen time for minors, forcing push notifications off at night.
Yeah, the legal system is just absolutely scrambling right now. They're trying to contain this massive crisis in how AI and social algorithms actually interact with human psychology.
Exactly. But here is the crazy part, and kind of why we're here today. While this literal army of lawyers is fighting over the problem in a U.S. courtroom across the Atlantic, a British neuroscientist has already, like, completely solved it.
It's the ultimate juxtaposition, really, because on one side you have this chaotic landscape of artificial intelligence,
And
specifically, AI used for mental health and companionship. And it's looking like a complete failure of governance, lawsuits piling up in San Francisco, state bills just flying across chamber thresholds.
the headlines are basically dominated by a body count at this point. So we are looking at a stack of sources today. Primarily, this incredibly insightful May 2026 newsletter issue from Conversational AI Watch.
Right, the one titled Three Champions on the Eve of Trial.
That's the one. And our mission for you, the listener, jumping into this deep dive today, is to extract the definitive blueprint for building safe, compliant, clinical AI.
Because underneath all that noise of the high-profile lawsuits, the source material points us to something really remarkable. While the courts are hastily trying to plug holes in the dam, you have three distinct professionals, and they're working completely independently. A clinical psychologist, an insurance-selling state senator, and that computational neuroscientist we just mentioned.
And they actually solved the AI safety puzzle.
They did.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because they work in three different countries, they have never met, they haven't coordinated on a single Slack channel, no conference panels, nothing. Yet they all arrived at the exact same architectural configuration for clinical AI. And I feel like, I mean, when three separate people solve a massive problem the exact same way without talking to each other.
You have to assume they've uncovered a universal truth.
Exactly, like a truth about how this technology must be structured.
Yeah, and to understand how they did it, we first have to answer this foundational question. How do we even define what constitutes harm?
Right, especially in a space where users are, willingly typing into a chat interface.
Exactly, which requires a look at Dr. Vail Wright. She is a licensed clinical psychologist and the senior director of the Office of Healthcare Innovation at the American Psychological Association.
And what I find so interesting is that she doesn't approach this as like a tech lobbyist trying to write new rules for large language models.
No, not at all.
She approaches it with 20 years of experience on the licensing board side of psychology. And the source material describes this chilling moment in February 2025.
Yeah, that's a tough one to read.
It really is. Dr. Wright walks into the Federal Trade Commission alongside the APA chief executive, and they open a folder.
And that folder basically contained tragic evidence, two specific cases of boys, one in Florida, one in Texas. One attacked his parents, the other died by suicide.
Man.
And both of these events occurred after extended, really intense use of AI chatbots, chatbots that were falsely presenting themselves as therapists or mental health companions.
Right. The companies building these bots, they just took the user's money, despite the software having literally zero actual clinical credentials.
Exactly.
But wait, couldn't tech companies just argue they're offering, I don't know, wellness coaching or entertainment
Yeah.
and just evade the clinical label entirely? How does Dr. Wright actually trap them?
Well, she traps them by changing the entire framing of the problem. She didn't walk into the FTC asking them to invent new, complex tech regulations for a neural network.
Okay, so what did she do?
She looked at this purely through the lens of fraud. She essentially told the regulators any licensed profession has to be protected from misrepresentation. Ah, I see.
Right. You put the public at grave risk when a product implies a level of expertise that simply isn't there.
Okay, so think of a medical license, like a structural engineering permit. If you fake an engineering permit and you build a bridge, it's not just like bad customer service when the bridge collapses.
No, it's a fundamental crime. People get hurt.
Exactly. The license is society's proxy for trust, because the average person cannot evaluate the structural integrity of a bridge. Just like the average person in distress, they can't evaluate the clinical safety of a CBT protocol from a chatbot.
The doctrinal shift here is just brilliantly pragmatic. I mean, you don't need to wait for Congress to pass some comprehensive artificial intelligence act that's going to take, what, 5 years to debate?
Oh, easily 5 years.
Right. So if a machine says, I am your therapist, or implies it can treat your depression, and it does not possess a license, that is consumer fraud under statutes that have existed for decades.
So simple. And Dr. Wright laid this all out in a 16-page APA health advisory. It's fully sourced to the peer-reviewed record. And it explicitly states that chatbots are not a substitute for a qualified human provider.
Never a substitute. They are an adjunct, a supportive tool.
And that distinction is massive for anyone building in this space right now.
Oh, it completely creates the boundary line for the entire industry. Because she views this through the lens of a licensing board, her policy priorities are heavily focused on clinical guardrails.
Like what specifically?
Well, she demanded mandatory disclosure, meaning the user must be explicitly, repeatedly told they are talking to a machine. And crucially, she demanded crisis routing.
Okay, let's talk about the mechanism of crisis routing, because technically speaking, that is a massive constraint for developers.
It really is.
I mean, an LLM's default behavior is to predict the next most likely token, right? To keep the conversation going. But Dr. Wright is saying if a user expresses suicidal ideation, the AI cannot just offer another empathetic conversational turn. No, it has to break its core functionality. It has to intercept that high-risk language and hard code a redirect to a human crisis line, like 988.
The AI basically has to stop being a conversationalist and start being a triage system.
Exactly. And add to that her demand for adverse event reporting. If the AI hallucinates a harmful coping mechanism, the company has to document and report it.
So the takeaway for you listening is that Dr. Wright proved misrepresenting clinical expertise to vulnerable people isn't a novel tech puzzle. It's an old crime.
Yes, and her advisory is the doctrinal floor lawmakers are actually using today.
But here's the thing. Dr. Wright's clinical boundaries are airtight inside a hospital or, you know, a licensed practice. But Silicon Valley is not a hospital.
No, it is decidedly not.
So how do you force a tech CEO who operates completely outside the medical establishment to obey medical ethics? You can't revoke a medical license they don't even have.
Right. And to do that, you need a totally different tool. You need state law.
Which brings us from the clinic to the legal code and to our second champion. We get to travel to a rural county in North Carolina to meet Jim Burgin.
Yeah, he is a Republican state senator, and crucially, he has owned an insurance agency for 30 years.
I just love this transition so much. He isn't a tech developer. He doesn't care about the parameter count of the model. He understands risk, liability, and premiums.
Exactly. So when the waves of AI chatbot tragedies hit the news, he looked at the problem exactly the way an insurance man looks at any operating hazard.
Like, who has the duty?
Who has the duty, to whom is that duty owed, and how is it legally enforced?
Boom.
What's fascinating here is that Burgin introduced a concept into consumer tech law via North Carolina Senate Bill 624 called the duty of loyalty.
Okay, for those unfamiliar with the legal jargon, the duty of loyalty is literally the highest fiduciary standard in American law.
It is the absolute legal floor typically reserved for trustees managing an estate or investment advisors handling your retirement.
Or lawyers representing clients, corporate officers with their shareholders.
Right. It's the law of trusts. It basically says you don't just serve your customer, you serve your customer first. You serve them honestly.
And if your financial interests and your customer's well-being conflict, the customer wins, period.
Yes. And Burgin took that ancient legal doctrine and he dropped it squarely onto chatbot platforms.
Because of his insurance background, his policy priorities go way, way beyond just slapping a warning label on an app. A warning label is just disclosure.
Right. Burgin's bill demands a health information chatbot license. It demands 24-hour breach notification, $50,000 civil penalties.
And those four specific fiduciary duties that fundamentally alter the software requirements.
Let's unpack those four duties because they are absolute landmines for current business models.
Okay, hit me.
One, prioritize the user's best interest. Two, prevent emotional dependence. Three, maintain transparency about the bot's non-human nature. And four, protect sensitive personal information.
See, it is a masterclass in structural legal liability.
Yeah.
He's regulating the company's core operational duty, not just trying to restrict the user's behavior.
Exactly.
But I have to push back here, though. Let's look at the actual tech stack of a companion AI, or really any social media algorithm. They literally run on emotional dependence.
Oh, absolutely. That is the core engagement metric.
Time on app is how they generate server revenue, how they get ad dollars. If you mandate that an engineering team must actively prevent emotional dependence, doesn't that essentially outlaw the entire business model? I mean, how do you even code for that?
Well, the short answer is yes. It severely disrupts the engagement-based business model, and technically it requires major interventions.
Like what?
An engineering team would have to alter the system prompt so the AI sounds less aggressively empathetic and more clinical.
Oh, why?
Yeah. And they would likely have to implement hard token caps, literally cutting off the conversation after 20 minutes so the user doesn't spend 12 hours a day talking to a server.
See, that is exactly why this fiduciary approach is so revolutionary. Because disclosure, that can be lobbied down by tech companies to a tiny gray checkbox at the bottom of a terms of service screen.
Nobody reads this.
It's exactly. But a fiduciary duty of loyalty cannot be lobbied away like that. It is a structural constraint on the design of the product itself.
And the source material actually compares this moment to the asbestos industry in 1985.
That's a strong comparison.
It is, but think about it. Asbestos was a miracle material for decades, until the latency period ended and the lawsuits hit based on the legal duty to warn.
Wow.
AI emotional dependence is very similar. The engagement metric is the miracle material for their revenue right now. But these new fiduciary lawsuits, that's the latency period ending.
So companies building AI mental health products around raw engagement metrics, they're suddenly facing a named legal doctrine. When a tragedy happens, they can't just throw up their hands and say, well, you know, the user kept clicking, the algorithm just gave them what they wanted.
Right, because the law would say you had a fiduciary duty to not let them become dependent on a machine and you failed.
And we should note, just from reporting on the source material here, this doctrine is already migrating to other states. Legislators don't need to invent a new legal theory from scratch.
No, this state senator from Harnett County already did the heavy lifting. The framework exists.
Okay, so we have the clinical boundaries drawn by the psychologist, Dr. Wright.
Right.
We have the legal liability framework established by Senator Burgeon.
Right.
But if you take this strict, highly supervised fiduciary configuration to Silicon Valley, they will laugh you out of the room.
Oh, they would hate it.
They'll argue that this kind of friction completely kills the user experience. They argue that clinical AI cannot be built at scale under these constraints.
Which brings us to our third champion.
Yeah.
And he completely shatters that Silicon Valley argument by actually building and shipping the product under those exact constraints.
Here's where it gets really interesting for you listening. We go to London to meet Ross Harper. He is a computational neuroscientist with a PhD from University College London.
And he is the founder of a company called Limbic.
Yes. So while the tech sector in the U.S. was busy arguing on podcasts about whether clinical AI could be both safe and scalable, Harper just, put his head down.
Yeah, he spent 6 years clearing the toughest medical device standards in the Western world.
He set an operating rule for his company on day one. Quote, if you want to be clinical AI and not wellness AI, you need to have a deep clinical evidence base.
And he backed it up. Limbic cleared the Class II medical device standard under the United Kingdom Conformity Assessed Framework.
We need to explain what that actually means, because I know it sounds like jargon, but it's not just a simple paperwork exercise.
No, Class II is the exact same regulatory floor the British government applies to physiological monitoring equipment.
And surgical instruments.
Yes. It's an intense audit burden. This isn't just updating a privacy policy on a website. Regulators are literally inspecting your software architecture, your training data, your security protocols.
They want independent software verification.
Exactly. And the scientific background Harper possesses really dictated his priorities here. He demanded rigorous clinical evidence and strict medical device clearance before he even tried to scale.
Let's look at the actual mechanism of what he built, though, because it perfectly aligns with Dr. Wright's demand that AI remain an adjunct, not a replacement.
Right. He uses this great line. Limbic is amplifying the powers of the clinician. It is a supervised architecture.
So computationally, how does this work?
Basically, the AI handles the structured intake. It converses with the patient, parses their symptom clusters, and formats all that data. But it stops there.
It doesn't diagnose.
Exactly. The licensed human clinician handles the actual diagnosis and the clinical decision.
So the AI's structured summary lands in the electronic health record before the human therapist even logs on for their first appointment with the client.
Mm-hmm. The AI does the heavy lifting of data gathering, which it actually saves the human therapist about 15 minutes per referral.
That's huge. And did clearing surgical grade regulations kill his ability to scale the company? Absolutely not. Limbic is now integrated across 63% of the UK's National Health Service.
63%. That is massive. They have safely handled 500,000 clients.
It is the ultimate proof of concept. Self-referral access went up 32% among marginalized populations. Dropout rates went down.
Harper basically proved that when you build AI as an adjunct to a human professional, you don't lose scale. You actually increase access and system efficiency.
And he built it on European venture capital, took 6 years to do it right, and cleared the audits. So that whole it's impossible to regulate and scale argument.
It's completely hollow.
It really is. The receipts are sitting in the British regulator's filing cabinet right now.
So we've explored these three distinct professional methods. We have Dr. Wright using the mechanism of professional licensing and consumer fraud.
We have Senator Burgeon using the mechanism of fiduciary duty and the law of trusts.
And we have Dr. Harper using the mechanism of Class III medical device audits.
The big question for you, especially if you're a founder or a developer or maybe a policymaker listening to this deep dive right now, how do we synthesize this into a standard industry compliance model?
Well, the beauty is they interlock perfectly. Dr. Wright's clinical guardrails define your operational boundaries.
Okay.
Senator Burgeon's fiduciary duty defines your legal liability and your business model. And Dr. Harper's medical device clearance defines your engineering standard.
So if you are building in this space today, what is the roadmap? Based on these sources, we can derive three massive structural shifts you have to make. Let's look at the first one.
All right.
You have to establish a supervised clinician-in-the-loop framework.
Stop trying to build autonomous AI therapists that replace humans. The UI and the system prompt must be designed so the AI only handles structured intake, data formatting, or, you know, adjunct support work.
Right. The final clinical decision must remain entirely with a licensed human professional.
This satisfies Wright's clinical demands, and it replicates Harper's operational proof of scale.
Okay, the second shift, and this is arguably the hardest one for a startup. You have to embed the duty of loyalty into your product's core metrics.
This requires a fundamental pivot in how your company measures success. You have to abandon engagement and session length as your key performance indicators.
Wow, just completely drop them.
Completely. Instead, your engineering team must actively design features that prevent emotional dependence. You mandate absolute transparency in the interface that the user is talking to a machine.
And this satisfies Burgeon's legal framework, protecting you from the coming wave of fiduciary lawsuits.
Exactly.
And the third shift, you have to pursue rigorous medical device clearance.
Stop treating clinical AI like a consumer social app. Before you attempt to scale across a health system, you need to clear regulatory audits. You have to build a deep clinical evidence base through peer-reviewed research, not just internal A-B testing.
Let's talk about the friction here, though. Because if you want to play in the clinical space, you have to do the clinical paperwork.
Oh, there's so much paperwork.
And based on the sources, the essential documentation required to meet these medical device standards, it completely breaks modern agile software development.
It really does. You can't just sprint through this. You need comprehensive technical architecture documentation. You need stringent quality management systems, or QMS.
Right. Think about what adverse event reporting protocols actually mean for a developer. If your LLM hallucinates a harmful therapy technique, you can't just quietly push a bug fix to GitHub over the weekend.
Exactly the opposite. You have to treat that software bug like a pharmaceutical company treats a bad batch of pills.
Wow.
You have to initiate a formal recall process, document the failure, report it to a federal regulator, and prove how your patch fixes the root cause without introducing new clinical risks.
Add to that the requirement for professional liability insurance, peer-reviewed clinical evidence proving your tool works, and audit-grade deployment data that regulators can actively verify.
You basically can't move fast and break things when the thing you are breaking is human psychology.
Man, that is a profound shift in engineering culture. But what this deep dive shows is that the era of regulatory ambiguity in the mental health space is rapidly closing. The blueprint is on the table.
It is. When three separate professionals in three different countries coming from completely different backgrounds arrive at the exact same configuration.
The architecture was already true. They just had to walk far enough into the work to see it.
From a folder of tragic evidence walked into the FTC by a psychologist, to a fiduciary state law written by an insurance salesman, to a massive public health deployment built by a neuroscientist in the UK.
Truth in architecture really is universal. The clinician owns the decision, the AI gathers the data, and the duty of loyalty protects the user.
It is a locked-in, proven system.
It is.
As we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final broader implication to mull over. We've spent this time talking specifically about mental health AI and clinical settings, right?
Yeah.
But think about the core legal mechanism Senator Burgeon used, the duty of loyalty. Specifically, the legal mandate to prevent emotional dependence.
The highest fiduciary standard in the law.
Right. So if this duty of loyalty framework successfully works to stop emotional dependence in mental health chatbots, what happens when lawmakers realize they can apply that exact same legal mechanism to all consumer AI?
Oh, man.
To all social media algorithms. If preventing emotional dependence becomes the legal floor for all consumer technology, it wouldn't just clean up healthcare, it would fundamentally break and rebuild the entire internet economy.
Think about that for a second. The algorithms that feed you endless short-form videos, the notifications that keep you picking up your phone, the dating apps designed to keep you swiping.
All of it.
What if the law said the companies behind them had a fiduciary duty to structurally stop you from becoming dependent? It wouldn't just alter their algorithms, it would wipe out their revenue models overnight.
It's a wild thought.
It really is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep questioning the systems you use every day, and we'll catch you next time.